This is an ABC podcast.
Hello there, I'm Nikolai Bailhuts. Welcome to the Country Hour. On the program today, who is going to put up their hand to buy SPC Ardmona? Late last week, its parent company, Coca-Cola Amatil, announced that the iconic fruit processing business is now officially up for sale. Some people are now asking who would want to take that business on, what their plans could well be for the brand. So we'll try and get a bit more detail on that. Also on the program today, it's usually the case that in drought, frost-affected years, grain is downgraded at receival sites because it's too small and faces a number of other challenges. This year, though, grain size seemingly has defied expectations. So is there a small silver lining to a challenging grain year? More on that soon too.
You're listening to the Country Hour on ABC Radio Victoria.
We do start today, though, with some other significant grain news. GrainCorp has confirmed that it's received a non-binding indicative takeover offer of $2.4 billion. The offer comes from a relatively little-known group, which says it's an asset manager for Australian investors. It's called Long Term Asset Partners. Mercado commodity analyst Andrew Whitelaw which joins us to find out more about this offer.
Well, GrainCorp is the largest listed grain storage company in Australia. Well, the only listed grain storage company. And on the East Coast, they have really the lion's share of the bulk handler storage space on the East Coast of Australia. But they're also, you know, I guess a very big player now in the malt industry with malt plants in Australia, but also malt plants in Europe and in back in sunny Scotland.
And we have heard today that GrainCorp has confirmed to the share market that it has received this non-binding takeover offer of $2.4 billion. Were you surprised to see this offer come through?
I think it's probably a surprise to everyone. It's an interesting offer, especially who the suitors are for this bid. But yeah, and it's going to leave a lot of interesting questions.
What do we know about this company or the trust, I should say, Long Term Asset Partners? They're the ones that have said we're interested in buying.
Really, not much at all. It's the company's been around since I think 2016. It's got a series of directors who are well known in the business world, but other than that, we don't really know much. And I think that's sort of also expressed in GrainCorp's statement to the ASX, in that they are a very little known enterprise, with this being their first investment, a rather large investment, and so GrainCorp are going to be doing their due diligence and before they make any form of recommendations, because it is a strong premium to the close on Friday, and GrainCorp shares have risen strongly as a result of that this morning so far. But I guess GrainCorp will be doing a lot of due diligence and erring on that side of caution after the last takeover attempt in 2013 by ADM was blocked by the Foreign Investment Review Board.
Yeah, and that's an interesting one. So because the ADM offer, so that was $3.4 billion, as you say, didn't get over the line back then. One of the things I noticed in the release to the ASX was there seemed to be language talking about, trying to get a bit more clarity about who these investors would be and potentially whether or not they're Australian and therefore would face those foreign investment review tests again or not.
Well, I guess GrainCorp aren't going to want to recommend something that is going to have a hard time getting across the line. And I think with there being so little known, or at least publicly known about this organization, they have said that the money in the fund is from Australian investors. But I guess GrainCorp will want to do their due diligence to make sure that it would pass the mustard with the Foreign Investment Review Board, and they've also expressed some, maybe not concerns, but made some points about it being a relatively complex debt structure for the deal.
And I guess, too, there'd be questions from some people, at least, about what it would mean for GrainCorp as a company in the future if it just continues on the way it is, or whether some assets would be sold off. But again, very early in those discussions.
Yeah, well, GrainCorp are going through their portfolio review just now, and there's all sorts of rumours around the industry. You know, there's been rumours that they're looking to buy Cargill's malt facilities, which would be a good alignment with their current malt business. But and these are, I guess, ways of not being so reliant on grain, which clearly in a year like this, if you're reliant on the Australian grain industry and money from storing grain, you'd be struggling quite a bit. And I guess it's a form of diversification away from what is a risky drought-related commodity.
Andrew Whitelaw, he's commodity analyst with Mercado. The Country Hour did ask to speak to GrainCorp about that offer, but GrainCorp declined.
The Country Hour on ABC Radio Victoria.
Let's stick with grains for the moment. Because as I say, it usually is the case in droughty, frosty years that grain will be downgraded at receival sites, generally because it's too small or it returns high screening results. But this year, grain size has seemed to defy expectations, perhaps thanks to the cool finish to the season. Bill Thompson from Emerald Grain says size and quality has been surprisingly good across the board.
Well, for the wheat crop, actually the grain that's come in to date has been of excellent quality. We've seen excellent grain protein content, so we've had quite a bit of grain come into our H2 segregation, so it's above 11.5% protein, and also grain come into our H1 segregation, over 13% protein. There's been very low levels of screenings in those grades as well. So the grains look pretty good, it just hasn't been enough of it, to be honest.
With that high protein in wheat, is that what we typically see in a drought year like this?
Yeah, it is. The really dry finish tends to result in a concentration of the protein into the seed. But sometimes if it's quite a severe finish, we get high screenings. But as I mentioned, we're not seeing those really high screenings, which is really pleasing.
So the screenings is the percentage of small grain. Is it surprising that there isn't more of that small grain, just given how tough the season has been?
Yeah, because I can recall some fairly high, decent frost a while ago, but it hasn't come through to impact the final crop. So, there's been very little downgrading because of high screenings.
Is that potentially the fairly kind end to the season from a temperature point of view, do you think, that has kept those screenings fairly low?
Potentially. I wouldn't hazard a guess at exactly what caused, probably a combination of a number of factors in such an unusual season that we've had.
Just talking a little bit more about frost, have there been any instances of loads of grain being turned away because they had too high of a portion of frosted grain?
I haven't heard that mentioned to me from any of our site managers, no. We haven't turned away any loads from our sites.
Now, talking barley, you did say earlier that quite a lot has been downgraded because of high protein, but there's still plenty of malt around as well.
Yeah, there's certainly got a reasonable tonnage of different malt grades, but we have also seen quite a bit of grain into our feed grade. And looking at some of the average quality data, proteins for that F1 have been quite high. So that's tending me to think that the main reason it's gone feed is because of the higher protein.
Now, just touching on canola, what sorts of oil yields have we seen?
I think the crushers will be pretty pleased with what canola is out there, because we're seeing sort of 41, 42% oil contents, and some years we can sort of see 37% oil content. So they're quite pleasing numbers.
So overall, Bill, what's the takeaway message from the receival sites this season?
Obviously, everyone suffered from the dry conditions, dramatically reducing the tonnage that's come in into sites. But for what has come in to date, it's been the quality's been really excellent. Obviously, we had recent rains the last week, and we may see some sprouted grain come in the once things dry out and farmers get going again. Which may need some weather damage grades to be added in to cover that.
So there could be special segregations created to account for that sort of event?
Yeah. We do have, if there's high protein but sprouted, so our fully numbered tests fall below the milling grades, we would try and segregate that out as opposed to just the general feed grade where it's low protein but weather damage. So would look to capture that and ensure that we maintain the integrity of the existing milling grades.
And just finally, Bill, what sorts of tonnages has Emerald Grain received, I guess, compared to its long-term averages?
Well, I guess we're probably three quarters of the way through harvest for most of Victoria and southern New South Wales. As with all storage receivers, probably below half of what would be a normal season. I think we initially had expectation that deliveries would be seemingly less than what we've seen. So there's been more out there than we had anticipated. So that's pleasing, but coming from a low base. So dramatically down on an average season, but what is out there is good quality.
Bill Thompson, Technical Services Manager with Emerald Grain, speaking with Angus Verley.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio Victoria.
It is 16 past 12. My name's Nikolai Bailharts. Well, some mixed farmers say they're turning to long-season canola now to try and provide their stock with feed over summer. Rather than the typical canola growing window of April to November, long-season canola is sown in spring and grows for more than 12 months before being harvested late the following year. Now, it's most popular in the high rainfall zone of southern Victoria, but some farmers in the Wimmera are giving it a go too. Banyina farmer David Byrne is a third-time grower. He's getting ready to put lambs on the crop he sowed a couple of months ago.
Yeah, I sown that in September, middle of September. Sat there for a month without actually, it probably did germinate when I look back at it, but there wasn't not much moisture. It was a bean crop that had a few weed issues that I ended up spraying out, so it was a bit of stored moisture there probably, but not a lot of the year panned out. But as soon as we got that rain, I had a 15 mil rain to get it to germinate, and yeah, it hasn't looked back. It's fine now. It looks really good.
So I'd imagine if you're already getting a grazing in November, and obviously dependent on how much summer rain we have, but you should get several opportunities to graze it, I'd imagine.
Yeah, I reckon we should be able to get a few grazes off it this year, which would be good for where we are. We're probably not really suited to growing this sort of stuff, really. It's probably more for a high rainfall area, but anyway, if we can make it work, we might get a bit out of it. Who knows? Just a bit of trial and error and see what happens.
So you'll graze it on and off through the summer and into the autumn, and then you'll lock it up at a certain stage to let it grow through to grain?
Yeah. We'll give it I've got a fair few lambs on this year, so I'll probably give it a fair fogging and see what it can stand, I suppose. We'll probably push the limits on it a bit and see how hard you can push it. It'll probably, depending on the season next year, we'll make the call as when to take the sheep off it, I suppose.
And do you think in the summer, when we do have those extremely dry spells, is it just inclined to sit there, I guess, and not grow rather than dying?
Yeah, it just hangs on. It's like it goes dormant. I don't know. I'm still sort of trying to learn the habits of it a bit. Once it gets a root system established, they're huge. Like they're a massive system there. And I had plenty of plants this year that were completely fried off that thought were dead, with one little tiny bit of green at the bottom. And yeah, sure enough, once it rained, they all come back to life somehow. I don't know how, but it's pretty incredible.
And do you think, all things being equal, that these types of canola can yield on par with other types?
Yeah, I suppose. I mean, according to my good friend Chris Welsh, he's a guru and all this stuff, he reckons it's going to be all right. But, I've actually... I'll call it an accidental trial, I suppose, but I've left a landing strip in this canola I've sown this year by some fault, which, that's all right, that happens. But, yeah, I'll chuck a bit of spring canola in there and see how they compare, I suppose, next year.
And obviously it's early days for you, but do you think the gross margins will stack up?
I think it will. If I can graze sheep on it, I think it's going to be great. Even if it yields, a bit less or whatever, if I can, I'm going to put about 1,000 lambs on 65 hectares, hopefully for a month, coming into summer, which is good green feed going into summer, is going to be a pretty handy thing for some lambs to, I just plant lambs just for them to be going on and off. So, it's normally like to run the feed lot, but with grain prices where they are, it's feed lotting's, getting a bit more harder work, I suppose, to make the numbers work as well.
So do you think it'll be something you keep doing and potentially do more of?
I'm just slowly stepping it up. It's gone from 8 hectares to 40 hectares to sort of nearly 70 hectares. So I think this year, the way I've done it, is a lot better trial, I suppose. It's giving it more of a chance to establish in the spring months. Yeah, I think there's a lot of room for it. I don't know how it's going to end up. We're still early days in the job, I suppose.
Panyina farmer David Burns speaking with Angus Fairley.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio Victoria.
It's 20 past 12. Well, it's a big question now. How can Melbourne's food bowl be protected and farmers on the peri-urban fringe supported? It is a question at the heart of the Foodprint Melbourne project, which is based at the University of Melbourne. Now, the latest report was released in July, and since then the group's been consulting with farmers, consumers and governments to try and come up with ideas to answer that question, like models supplying direct to customers, things like farm incubators. Our reporter Jess Davis spoke with Dr. Rachel Carey, who leads the project.
The Foodprint Melbourne project at the moment is now focusing on how we could plan the city differently so that we're able to keep Melbourne's food bowl as Melbourne grows as an important building block and more sustainable and resilient food supply for the city. So we've been running a series of workshops where we've brought stakeholders together from different sectors. So farmers, people from industry, NGOs, local and state government to identify approaches to strengthen food production on Melbourne's food bowl.
So what are people saying to you? What ideas are coming forth out of this process?
Yeah. So in terms of the ideas that are coming out of the workshops, one of the key issues emerging at the moment is this idea of strengthening links between cities and farmers on their fringes. So as I said, one of the benefits of farming on the fringes is that farmers are close to market. So they've got this opportunity to be supplying direct to consumers and businesses and to take a greater share of the food dollar and also more control over their own supply chain. So, and some of those things include, for instance, the idea of smaller scale farmers supplying direct consumers from the farm gate, also of course through farmers markets and through community supported agriculture schemes. And that's where consumers buy a share of the farm's produce for a year and receive a regular box. But we could be making it much easier for consumers to recognise food that's produced locally by, say, introducing a provenance brand for food that comes from Melbourne's food bowl, and Toronto's done a really good job of that. They have a Greenbelt Fresh brand on products that come from their local food bowl, so consumers can recognise that. And also, we already have smaller scale farmers on Melbourne's fringe supplying direct to local chefs, but that could happen more in future. So chefs are farmers, for instance, are starting to grow unusual ingredients to order for chefs. And there's an opportunity for Victorian farmers to be supplying food to government-owned services, so say to hospitals, to prisons, to local government Meals on Wheels services. So if government was to introduce food procurement or buying guidelines that would allow those services to preference Victorian farmers when they're buying food, that's something that's actually becoming quite common in other countries as well, like the United States and Canada and the UK. And another idea emerging from the workshops is to be encouraging Melbourne residents to develop a closer connection with those food growing areas on the fringe. So through tourism and leisure activities. So for example, bike trails that connect up farms through farm gate trails. And again, that's something that Toronto does very well. So Toronto's introduced signs all around its green belt, when the green belt in Toronto is like Melbourne's green wedges. And those signs tell people when they're entering and leaving the city green belt, and that promotes the area to the general public. And they've developed a bike trail that connects up those areas of the Greenbelt and walking trails that encourage people to spend more time in those areas. And another couple of ideas that have emerged from the workshops, and one is the idea of farmer incubators. So one of the issues that new and young farmers face is it's really quite difficult to access land on the city fringe and to afford to buy land. And that's particularly difficult on the fringe because the cost of land is higher. So the idea of farmer incubators is to help farmers to access land on the city fringe and to help them also just gain the knowledge and skills to enter farming.
How has your research been received by all of those different groups?
Well, I think there's really quite strong support for this type of approach overall. And I think there's really growing awareness of the need to be protecting these food growing areas. It's I think is rising both on the public agenda and on the agenda of local governments as well. People see that it just makes sense to be protecting these areas for the future. Initially, when we first started this project, there was relatively low public awareness.
How important is that public awareness to influence how governments and councils put together their policies?
I think public awareness is crucial. In the longer term, public awareness really creates a social and political license for action to address the issues and to ensure that we really create certainty for these areas of food production in the long term.
So what policies are you trying to get implemented or are you working on with governments?
The recommendations that have come out of the project today really focus around a couple of key issues. One is that we have to create certainty for farming areas on the city fringe by introducing long-term planning, so designating areas that we know on the fringe of cities that will not ever be developed and that will be preserved as farmland for future generations. So that's really important for giving both farmers and other stakeholders the certainty to invest. And we would also really like to see government send a very strong signal about the future of Melbourne's green wages particularly. But crucially, it's not enough to protect farmland. It has to be viable for farmers to farm in those areas.
Dr. Rachel Carey from the Foodprint Melbourne Project, speaking with Jess Davis.
The Country Hour on ABC Radio Victoria.
Where it is 26 past 12. Now, just how important is the live export market for cattle farmers? It's been a bit of a disputed point, with those opposed to the trade saying it could be shifted to other things like chilled beef exports. Well, according to a new report that has been commissioned by the live export industry, it's worth $1.2 billion and accounts for 13% of Australia's total cattle industry value. Matt Dalgleish is a market analyst with Mercado. He told Sally Bryant the industry provides nearly 10,000 full-time equivalent jobs.
This was commissioned quite a few months back from LiveCorp and MLA to get Mercado to have a look at the live cattle industry broadly across the whole of the country and the benefit that flows from the live cattle trade and that sector into various parts of regional Australia.
What do you think are the most interesting features of this?
I think there's a couple of factors there that go to show the analysis on employment. So employment numbers on farm and also employment that's off farm and related to industries that are involved in live cattle, like your transport and fodder suppliers and veterinarians and all the other industries that hang off the fringe. The size of that, which is nearer to about 10,000 full-time jobs around the country. And also the other key thing that came out of the report when we did some value chain analysis was the proportion of the revenue that actually is retained on farm. And we're talking like something around the tune of $620 million a year that goes back to the farm across the country. So it's about 40 to 57%, depending on what the region is you're looking at. It's higher in the northern region and a bit lower in the southern regions, but somewhere between 40 to 57% of the revenue of that value chain to the destination port ends up going back to the farmer.
Were there any surprises from your perspective looking at what's come out of this?
From our perspective at Mercado, we're looking at these kind of markets all the time. We're constantly analysing data. We've got a significant in-house database. So from us we weren't super surprised on what we could see there, but it really just looks at those numbers and data and then just tries to paint as quickly as possible a visual picture of the importance of the industry. So I think for people that maybe aren't as exposed to the industry or aren't looking at the big picture, it gives them a real clear understanding as to how important this industry is for the whole of the country and certainly for parts of regional remote communities within the country.
So this was apparently commissioned around 6 months or more ago?
I reckon it was May from memory, so nearly 6 months now.
So without speculating about why it was commissioned, it would seem to have preempted any recent discussions from the federal opposition about their attitude to live exports?
It was commissioned well before that. I think it came off the back of a report that we undertook at Mercado for West Australian farmers based around the live sheep trade. And I think then there was an interest there with the cattle industry to say, oh, maybe we need to have something, that just paints the picture as to the importance of the cattle side of the live export trade.
I heard Joel Fitzgibbon speaking at the National Farmers Federation conference earlier this year. He was pretty scathing about the live export industry, and he didn't specify sheep or cattle, so I'll just assume he was talking about both, their ability to respond to criticisms in the industry, you know, of the way things are managed, that would indicate that his approach would be he's against live export across the board, because he says that they haven't responded to criticism, they haven't managed their case well. It is going to make life very interesting in the lead up to a federal election, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, and I think certainly any party that's in power, I think, are going to take a measured approach and a close look at how important the industry is before they make any rash decisions, I would hope. And certainly this kind of report is something that can help to frame the context around how they look at the industry and how they look at the benefits of the industry. In terms of comments made, I also haven't seen any clear regarding a separation between live cattle or live sheep from Joel Fitzgibbon, but it'll certainly be interesting to see how it develops and as we lead into the election, when policies start to become announced that are more specific, exactly the tone in which they're going to take.
That's market analyst from Mercado, Matt Dalgleish. It's 29 to 1 on the Country Hour. Time to get the latest in local news headlines now with Jess Black. Afternoon, Jess.
Good afternoon, Nikolai. A man who died in a house fire in the state's north this morning may have attempted to extinguish the blaze. The fire broke out in a home in Murrungie just before 6 o'clock. A second man suffered minor injuries. A court has heard a woman murdered in central Victoria was previously charged with biting the man accused of killing her. Charles Mackenzie Ross Evans is facing a committal hearing charged over the murder of Alicia Little near Kyneton last year. The Bendigo Magistrates Court has heard extra charges have been laid against the 44-year-old man. The bulk grain handler GrainCorp has revealed it's received a takeover offer. The company has told the stock exchange, a group known as Long Term Asset Partners, has made the indicative offer of $10.42 per share, said to be worth $2.4 billion. Police say a brawl involving more than 10 people involved a person getting their finger severed near Moe on Friday night. Moe Road was closed off for 18 hours and 5 people were taken to hospital. The Horsham Golf Club says it's avoided going into liquidation after a community fundraising campaign. Directors had till yesterday to raise $300,000 before they considered whether to put the club into administration. The club is almost $1.5 million in debt. And that's ABC News.
Thanks very much, Jess Black there with local news headlines. Now let's head off to the Bureau of Meteorology. Our senior forecaster, Richard Carline, is on duty. Afternoon, Richard.
Good afternoon, Nikolai.
There's a bit of rain over the course of the weekend. I think Saturday overnight into Sunday was the main bit. Did anybody end up with significant totals?
That's right. It was Saturday night, early Sunday morning, when a band of showers and storms moved through the central district and into parts of West Gippsland. A few places over the east central had some falls of 10 to 20 millimetres. The highest falls were in West Gippsland ranges, where there were some falls around 25 millimetres. But it was fairly localised, with not too much of that activity reaching the north of the state or even the south west. And since then, we've had a series of fronts moving through Bass Strait, which has kept conditions quite cool and windy as well. And there is a front about to cross Tasmania, which is keeping the wind fresh to strong and gusty along the coast and fairly fresh inland as well. It's likely to bring more wind than rainfall. We are seeing a smattering of showers through southern parts of the state, but we haven't seen any great falls yet, and we're not expecting any decent falls out of today's shower activity. Maybe some falls of around 5 millimetres near the coast, but remaining southern areas between 0 and 2 millimetres and nothing for the north of the state. It is clouding over most of the state. It's sunny over the far northwest and far east Gippsland as well, but fairly cloudy and temperatures just slightly below average. High teens expected this afternoon in the south and around the low to mid-20s for the north of the state. Now, tomorrow, behind the last of the cold fronts, it will still be fairly cool. The next high pressure system is moving in fairly quickly, so by late tomorrow that will be approaching the southwest of the state. So tomorrow, cool to mild with isolated showers in the south during the morning. It should be fine in the afternoon in the south and dry right through the north during the day. It should be mostly sunny over the north. For the south, we'll have mostly cloudy conditions. A few patches of sun, I think, towards the end of the afternoon. And tomorrow's temperatures will be fairly similar, maybe a degree or two higher in the north of the state, but for the south, around the 17 to 21 degree mark, so not much change there. The wind's moderating fairly rapidly tomorrow morning with the approach of that high. That high skips across to the Tasman Sea fairly quickly on Wednesday, and that starts, well, that's the first real sign of the heat gathering this week. Towards the end of the week, it certainly does look like a hot end to the week, and that heat will be building on Wednesday with northerly winds. We'll see temperatures move to the mid-30s in the north. Inland southern areas around the high 20s, but still a sea breeze on the coast will keep conditions mild there, around the low to mid-20s there, and it should be fine and sunny. Fine and sunny on Thursday as well, but the northerly winds will become a tad stronger, should extend the heat to most areas right to the coast. So we'll see temperatures in the mid to high 30s in the north and the low 30s in the south. Maybe an afternoon sea breeze along the Gippsland coast. There could be some milder places there, but warm to hot across most of the state on Thursday. Now, Friday will start out hot with a freshening northerly wind. We'll have a low-pressure trough approaching from the west. It'll reach the southwest during the morning, central and northeastern areas during the afternoon, and then it'll become fairly slow-moving during the night. And we'll see a cooler subtly change, but not much in the way of rainfall. It looks very summery, with just some isolated thundery showers possible in the south near the change. It certainly will cool off in the south, but not too much relief for the north of the state. But in the north, we're expecting temperatures close to 40 degrees, around the mid-30s in the south. But moving into the weekend, we'll see temperatures drop to the low to mid-20s in southern Victoria, but not as much relief for the north, temperatures dropping to perhaps the mid-30s. And we'll see some afternoon showers on both days, mainly over the eastern ranges. So that front later in the week will certainly cool things off in the south for the weekend, but staying warm to hot in the north of the state. And for fire dangers, I think the worst day will be Friday with that freshening northerly wind and high temperatures. So we may see some fire weather warnings issued on that day.
Okay, thanks very much, Richard.
Thanks, Nikolai.
Richard Carline, senior forecaster on duty at the Bureau of Meteorology. A few of your texts through. We were talking about live exports a few minutes ago. Jeff from Lang Lang says, if it was profitable to export chilled beef, then AACo wouldn't have closed the NT abattoir. And a few rain texts as well. One person says it's raining in Corumburra at the moment. And Jake from Dean got 9 millimetres on Saturday night and got to spend my 30th birthday having the day off. Well, congratulations. Happy birthday, Jake. And I should say, too, a little happy birthday to us as well. The Country Hour, 73 years old today and going strong.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio Victoria.
Well, it is 22 to 1. My name's Nikolai Beilharts. Now, if you were listening at the start of the show today, we were talking about the idea of GrainCorp maybe selling and buying businesses. And as you may have heard, they're not the only ones. SPC Ardmona is now officially for sale as well. Its owner, parent company, Coca-Cola Amatil, announced to the Stock Exchange on Friday that the business, along with IXL and Taylor's, will be put up for sale. Rhiannon Tuffield spoke with Alison Watkins from Coca-Cola Amatil.
Completed our $100 million reinvestment into SPC, and in particularly into the Shepparton site. That was a co-investment that we made with the Victorian government, and that program went over 4 years. So getting to the end of that, we made the decision that it was logical to step back and look at the strategic growth options for the business, and we have been conducting that process over the last couple of months. Today we've decided that we are going to go ahead with divestment. We've got a great level of interest in the business as far as alternate owners go, and we do think that that makes the most sense. The business is really well set up to grow. We really see a very bright future as a result of the investment that we've made, which really now allows the business to play in a whole lot of product categories and also export markets that we previously didn't have.
So today it was announced that it's operating at a $10 million loss this year. What do you think has gone wrong to contribute to that $10 million loss?
Oh, look, the $10 million loss is actually not a big deal in the scheme of things. So it's a modest loss, I would describe it as. And it's really, reflects the investment that we've been putting in the business. We continue to develop marketing. The challenge for the business is top-line growth, and the cost structure of the business now is very good. So what will move that loss to a profit and do so pretty readily is growth. So more volume and more revenue, and that's what the business is really poised to do.
And who do you hope buys SPC? Do you want it to remain in, I guess, Australian hands?
There's a lot of different interested parties, and we are very concerned, most of all, to have an owner of the business who is absolutely committed to a long successful future for the business, based out of Shepparton, with all of the positives for the Goulburn Valley. So an owner who really recognises the provenance credentials that and the history and the strength of the brands and everything that SPC stands for, and really, really values that very, very highly. So someone who really is going to be able to drive the growth and maximise the volume and top-line growth, that's what will be our most important criteria.
Yeah, and so you guys received some funding about 4 years ago with the Victorian government to invest in SPC. I guess, do you believe that it's fair that you're selling it now after that investment?
Oh, there's no question that investment by both of us and the Victorian government put $22 million in, you're absolutely right, alongside our $78 million. That combined $100 million investment has really secured the future of SPC. You might recall back in 2013 there was serious consideration that the Shepparton facility might be closed down and the manufacturing taken offshore. So with that co-investment, we've got the new lines, the snack line, the new tomato line. We've driven the export opportunities. We've got the new pouch line. So there's a lot of benefit from that investment, which at its heart means that manufacturing facility now is a competitive one and a one that has a bright future, which it did not have in 2013. So I believe the investment alongside us by the Victorian government was absolutely vital and absolutely has paid off in shoring up that really important business for the Goulburn Valley.
That's Managing Director of Coca-Cola Amatil, Alison Watkins, speaking with Rhiannon Tuffield.
The Country Hour on ABC Radio Victoria.
17 to 1. Now, when you think of the vineyards around Rutherglen, you probably think of rich tradition as one phrase that comes to mind. But rising temperatures, earlier picking times and changing export markets are keeping the well-established wineries in the area on their toes. Our reporter Megan Ruth visited a seventh-generation winery to find out more.
30 years ago, our hottest days were in the mid-30s, and now our hottest days are in the mid-40s. It's not unusual to have 2-3 weeks on end of 45-degree heat. The reason why we planted particularly the whites was because we were thinking of climate change and what could we do in the future. And, you know, my children are seventh-generation vignerons, and I have a grandson, he's eighth generation, so we really need to be looking to the future.
This is Wendy Killeen, CEO of Rutherglen Wine Royalty, Stanton and Killeen.
We're on the Murray Valley Highway, 3 kilometres west of Rutherglen. We're in a vineyard that grows our Portuguese varieties as well as Muscadel, which in Australia now, well, in Rutherglen we now call Topaque. And I think there's a bit of Muscat in here somewhere as well. So there's about five or six varieties in this vineyard.
You might have noticed Wendy Killeen mentioned Portuguese varieties. This is important. As the climate in northern Victoria gets hotter, harvest is getting earlier, and winemakers are seeking grapes which withstand the heat but still retain flavour. This is Stanton and Killeen winemaker Andrew Drum.
The change in climate really means that grapes ripen earlier, but it also means we're not getting quite the temperature range we used to get, so nights actually can stay hotter. That has quite an impact on the acidity of wines. And one of the great things about the Portuguese varieties is they actually seem to retain that acidity. So the grapes don't get cooked. And this seems to come back to the climate in southern Portugal in particular, which is actually hotter than here. I know many Aussies struggle to sort of cope with the concept that there can be hotter weather. But Portugal actually gets very, very hot. And so one of the reasons why we're interested is a lot of our grape varieties in Australia are actually sourced from France. But we think the varieties we've got here are probably better suited to an Australian climate.
Visionary winemaker Chris Killeen made a real investment in Portuguese drops about 30 years ago, earning him the local nickname as the Prince of Port. His family has continued the legacy, most recently planting two more varieties 3 years ago, as Wendy Killeen explains.
The Alvarinho and the Arinto are full-flavoured varieties. The Arinto has a higher acidity level. The Alvarinho, if I was to say it was like anything in Australia, it would be a full-bodied Riesling, I guess. It's got loads of flavour, but it's nice and dry. And the Arinto is finer. They've both got a lot of flavour. They've got a lot of mouthfeel. There's texture and perfect food wines.
While the new block will only make a small batch for select markets at this stage, the winery is making huge inroads in Asia. According to Wine Australia, China has become Australia's biggest and most valuable wine export market. Wendy Killeen is experiencing the boom firsthand.
We've been exporting Muscat and Topaque, which is both fortified, to the United Kingdom for 25 years. And 3 years ago, the Victorian government brought to the state 100 wine buyers, mainly from Asia. And we hadn't thought about exporting to China. But since then, we have grown our export market, I don't know, three, fourfold. When you have an export market, you need to service it. You can't just expect to send a pallet of wine or a container of wine to a country and just let it sit there. You need to travel to those areas and you need to get out on the street and sell your wine and talk your wine. And when I travel into those markets, I do masterclasses, I host events, dinners, I get in the car and I drive all over the countryside and sell our wine. You have to talk and live and breathe your wine.
Over the hill you've got a Shiraz vineyard that's 100 years old.
Almost 100
years old. We're standing here in a vineyard that's just 3 years old.
Yes.
What do you think it means for the region, for the Rutherglen region, to move with the times but also have that balance with what you're known for?
Rutherglen was first planted in the 1850s. We planted our first vineyard in 1875, so Rutherglen is a region with rich history. And, you know, we still need Shiraz, we need Jerif, we need Muscat, we need Muscadel. And we've all got those traditional varieties in our vineyards. There's 19 wineries here in Rutherglen. For us, I mean, we're all looking at different ways to progress into the future. You know, we need to be relevant for the next 50 years, I suppose, the next generation.
Winemaker Andrew Drum agrees.
Everyone thinks that these old regions have stayed exactly the same, but Rutherglen started out purely focused on making fortified wines for gold miners. Obviously, one of the most profitable ways to mine gold was to sell wine to gold miners, I suspect. But Rutherglen has changed over the years. So yes, there was the focus on fortifieds, but and we've kept that focus. So we look forward, but we also protect the past, and so consequently we're constantly evolving. And that's what people forget about the old wine regions, is they're still here for a very good reason, which is that they're constantly looking at what they do and why they do it.
The very futuristic sound of electronic pruning shears, ending Megan Ruth's report from Stanton Colleen Winery near Rutherglen in northern Victoria. 11 to 1 here on the Country Hour on ABC Radio Victoria. My name's Nikolai Bailharts. Well, the volunteer recovery effort from the devastating St Patrick's Day fires is now winding up 9 months after it began. On the 16th of December, Blaze Aid will close its camp at Cobden, marking the occasion with a free community celebration. Christine Mayle, Cobden Blaze Aid Camp Coordinator, says the trail of destruction left by the fires was a confronting scene.
Well, it was absolutely massive. There was wandering stock, devastated farmers and property owners, and it was just generally heartbreaking to see. But there's a very proactive council at Tungamide, and they very quickly got themselves organised, and we've been fortunate enough to be able to work with them to try and repair some of the damage that was done by the St Patrick's Day fires.
And the recovery that farmers and Blaze Aid was faced with, did that seem insurmountable?
It did, and at times now even, it still does. Farmers are just under so much pressure. The dairy industry's been under pressure for quite some time, and this fire was almost the last straw for a lot of people.
Now, can you talk me through, Chris, I guess, just how much Blaze Aid has achieved since then?
Yes, we've completed over 600 kilometres of fencing. We've had 650 volunteers go through our camp.
And 650 volunteers, have they been local people or have they travelled from afar?
We've had quite a few Tasmanians. We've had some folk from as far away as Western Australia and as far north as Queensland. So they've come from all over, New South Wales and South Australia, as well as local and local to Victoria, as well as local to Cobden.
Have they been majority retirees?
Greatly so. Our average age through the course of this camp has been almost 70 years.
And that must be pretty extraordinary to see, I guess, this band of retirees being so productive and helpful.
They are awesome. You get lots of retired, particularly farmers, and they just want to have something to do and a purpose. And I think sometimes when the farmer sees the car pull up and four grey heads pop out of the car, he or she might be inclined to think, oh, heck, what have I got here? And by day's end, we've achieved for them what would have taken them a fortnight. So it's a wonderful relationship that we have with them.
What's been the reaction in the local community among the farmers that you've helped to what Blaze Aid's done?
Oh, they're awesome. Very grateful for the help. They think we're terrific. And it's just something to be really proud of, proud to be a part of, privileged to be a part of. I'm very grateful for the support we receive from the farming community as well as the local community more broadly.
And how much work have you got left to do?
Well, I hope not too much. There's a lot of tidying up and finishing off to be completed at this stage.
And those farmers that you have helped, how are they getting on? Are they getting back on their feet?
Yes, they are. And it's when you go into a camp and you're initially a little bit overwhelmed with the destruction, and then you spend quite a bit of time cleaning up, and then the mood changes when you move from cleaning up into construction and rebuilding fences and sorting that sort of things out. And then the mood changes again when you're near the finish because we can all see a light at the end of the tunnel.
Christine Mayle, the coordinator of the Cobden Blaze Aid Camp, speaking there with Angus Furley. Off to the market, starting today at Mortlake with Derek Estrain.
Good afternoon, Nikolai. It was a very mixed increased offering of 1,039 cattle here at Mortlake that attracted a couple of extra buyers. Yearlers sold on average 10 cents higher and yearlings were from unchanged to 15 cents dearer. The plainer grown steers were from equal to 10 cents cheaper, but the better quality made up to 5 and 10 cents more. Poor quality cows also lifted 5 to 10 cents, with better cows mostly unchanged. Restockers and processors paid from 220 to 290 cents for average to good quality veelers and from 235 to 280 cents a kilogram for the yearlings. C3 and C4 grown steers made from 248 to 300 cents. Most C3 and C4 grown heifers, 240 to 258. Only average quality C3 and C4 cows mainly came forward this week and they sold between 201 and 215 cents. The cheaper D2 cows were from 155 to 186, the D1 cows 158 to 176, and the few dearer E1 grade 120 to 155 cents a kilogram. It's been Eric Australian reporting for MLA from Mortlake.
Thanks very much, Eric. And now to Pakenham and Brendan Fletcher.
G'day, Nikolai. Numbers increased to 1,740. That's 220 more, with the usual buying group operating more selectively in a cheaper market. Quality was fairly mixed, with some very good drafts amongst plenty of secondary lots. Most trade cattle sold from firm to 7 cents easier. Grown steers and bullocks eased 3 to 4 cents and more on some sales. Heavy Friesian steers eased 7. Crossbreds lifted slightly. Heavy bulls held firm. Most veelers sold from 245 to 315. Yearling trade steers 257 to 275. Heifers to the trade 222 to 288. Grown steers 255 to 288. Bullocks 252 to 285. Heavy Friesian steers 192 to 233, crossbreds 225 to 274, the better shaped heavy bulls 218 to 250. This is Brendan Fletcher reporting for MLA with 300 cows still to be sold.
Thanks, Brendan. Now to Wagga and Leanne Dax.
Numbers lifted to 4,380 in a mixed yarding, with most cattle in secondary condition. There were this week increased lighter weight cattle under 280 kilos, trade cattle are limited, and domestic processes are subdued. Heavy grown steers and bullocks in reasonable number. However, a lot of the steers lack finish. Weaner steers back to the paddock and heifers are selling 15 cents cheaper. Feeder steers sold 9 cents easier. No trade steers to quote. Trade heifers are back 3 cents, 246 to 274. Feeder heifers have slipped 3 to 4 cents, 215 to 272. Heavy grown steers and bullocks 9 to 10 cents cheaper, 220 to 276. Heavy cows has split 12 cents, 195 to 218, and leaner grades, 7 to 8 cents, back 142 to 196. I'm Leanne Dax for MLA.
Thanks, Leanne. Now to Bendigo and Jenny Kelly.
Good afternoon. Numbers dropped to 16,000 lambs, or 8,000 less. Quality also declined, and light lambs dominated the yarding, with good trade and export slaughter lambs in short supply. Demand from processors was dull, and the market was cheaper and sometimes erratic. Heavier sucker lambs over 24 kilos were backed by around $15, while the medium trades were mostly $5 to $9 easier. The big change in the market was across the store lambs, with the volume New South Wales orders not here this week. This lowered the plainest and small store lambs under 16 kilos by $10 to $20 a head. The better grown store lambs with more frame and size fared better to be $2 to $5 down. One heavy pen of suckers estimated over 32 kilos carcass weight reached a top of $228. The next best price was $192. The main run of 22 to 24 kilo crossbred suckers made from $142 to $180 to average around $162 at an estimated 660 cents a kilo carcass weight. The 20 to 22 kilo lambs averaged around $150 to also be sitting around 660 cents. The best of the trade weight shorn lamb sold to $183 and did sell slightly better on a carcass basis. Jenny Kelly for MLA.
Thanks, Jenny. And now to Hamilton and Tim Delaney.
Good afternoon. Hamilton Agents yarded 23,515 lambs. New season lambs continue to arrive. Quotas from average to good to range from heavyweight lambs to medium weights and many lines of light trade to light lambs, suiting both processors and restockers. Average rate overall was less, especially in the heavy lambs, compared with some earlier sales. Usual Monday lamb buyers attended and operated in the market at fluctuate times after a solid start. Light lambs ended up selling at $2 to $5 cheaper. Light and medium trade weight lambs sold from firm to $3 stronger. Heavy lambs were unchanged and average to some sales slightly dearer a few dollars. Restockers from Horsham at Ballarat and locally were busy as they paid $89 $135, selling from firm to slightly easier on last Wednesday. Lightweight lambs, two schools, made from $78 to $118. Light trade weight, two and three schools, from $114 to $134, averaging $6.85. Medium trade weight, three school lambs sold from $134 to $165. Heavy trade weight lambs sold from $160 to $182. The average also an estimated $6.85. Heavy lambs, the three and four schools, sold from $173 to $190. Heavier pens of four score export young lambs sold from between $190 to the market top of $238. It's been Tim Delaney reporting for MLA Hamilton.
Thanks very much, Tim. And that is the Country Hour for today. Don't forget, you can get a podcast of the program. Download it, subscribe to it, and it will be delivered to you. You can listen to it when it suits you. So you can find that on iTunes or wherever you get all of your podcast regular details. You can find all of that up on the web. And there's some information on how to do it up on our website too, abc.net.au/rural. One o'clock.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.